days passed, and the plant seemed fine. It continued to grow. Little roots started to appear. And then about 2 weeks later, he went back and tried to light the candle, and the candle lit. This little flame appeared. So somehow the plant was creating that combustible air. And in that little vessel, in that little kind of globe with this little plant, was a clue to how our whole planet evolved and the history of life on this planet.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulibi. This week, author Stephen Johnson reads from his new book, The Invention of Air, A Story of Science, Faith, Revolution, and the Birth of America. Joseph Priestley was an 18th century scientist and philosopher who made up for a lack of formal training with pure intellectual inquiry. On the one hand, he's the subject of Johnson's book. On the other, he's the embodiment of a kind of figure we don't see much of these days, someone who's mastered many fields and whose genius came from seeing a sort of interplay between them. Stephen Johnson has written a number of books about science and interconnectedness. He's also a web entrepreneur who started the popular websites Plastic and Feed. This reading of The Invention of Air took place in January 2009 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
Thank you so much. I'm going to talk. I'm not going to read. I'm going to do one brief reading, which is a little trick I've learned about how to excel at book readings, which is to not read your own words, but to read Thomas Jefferson's words. That always works really well. And, when you start, this is the first book that I've written about this period in American and British history and the Founding Fathers. And on the one hand, it's very promising because a lot of people are interested in this topic, as you know. On the other hand, if it doesn't go well, you're on that track towards being a Founding Father impersonator, which so I may, by the end of the tour, be wearing a powdered wig or something like that. I gave a talk at the Franklin Institute, where I'm going to be on Friday night in Philadelphia, but I gave a talk there a few months ago, and as I was walking in the door, there was an actual Ben Franklin impersonator there. And Franklin is a huge figure in this book, and I'd spent a lot of time reading these letters between Franklin and Priestley. And so as I walk in the door, and there's Ben Franklin there, and I introduce myself and said, "Hey, I just wrote a book about you." And he was totally in character and said, "Oh, really? That's very interesting. Priestley, yes. Well, Priestley and I met many years ago. It was 1765, I believe." And so that I'm not going to actually do any more impressions, but that may be in my future. I'm going to tell you a little bit about how I got to this story. As some of you know, I wrote a book, two books ago, about video games and pop culture, and then went to the next logical thing, which was 19th century cholera. And now I figured the only thing more exciting than 19th century cholera was 18th century chemistry. And so here I am with this book. But I got to it through this kind of roundabout way, which was that I was going to write a bigger book, which I think I'm still going to write, about innovation and the spread of ideas. And one of the things that I had been writing and thinking a lot about is ecosystems and how the metaphor of ecosystems is useful to think about the way that information flows through a society. And it was a theme that showed up a little bit in The Ghost Map, the last book. And so I was kind of researching back into ecosystem science and reading a little bit about it for ideas. And I stumbled across the story about Joseph Priestley. And I had known a little bit about Priestley. Like most people, I think I had heard of him as the guy who had discovered oxygen for the first time. And for those of you who know the story, who have had a chance to look at the book, that is his reputation. It's a little bit strange because he didn't actually do it first, and he kind of got it wrong in some fundamental ways when he did do it. But for some reason, that's the line that has kind of stuck with him, and that's the first sentence of his Britannica entry and his Wikipedia entry, is that he's the guy who discovered oxygen. But I found out this other very interesting thing about him, which I think he deserves a lot more credit for, and part of this book is kind of evangelizing this one discovery of his career, which is that he was the first person to realize that plants were creating oxygen. And it's really quite an extraordinary story. And what basically happened is, if you go back kind of and look at the history of the science at that period, the whole question of investigating air as a problem that science should wrestle with was something that took a long time for people to even realize. I mean, if you think about it, you look around yourself and you see lots of things that are probably worthy of studying. There's people and their bodies, and there's matter, and there's trees out there, and there are clouds in the sky, and all that kind of stuff. But the invisible space between us all didn't occur to anybody to be all that interesting for a long period of time. And it wasn't really until the 1600s when people first proved that there was this thing called kind of anti-air. There were vacuums where all the air had been pulled out of a space and it behaved very distinctly differently from traditional air. Candles wouldn't light in it, for instance. Bells wouldn't ring in it. And so people started to think, well, wow, there must be this invisible substance that's kind of floating around us that we can't see, but that somehow is probably worthy of study. And through the 1700s, people started to think that maybe it was composed of different gases. It wasn't just one single unified thing. And that was about where the study of pneumatic chemistry was when Priestley got interested in it. Now, Priestley was a very, you know, classic Enlightenment era figure. He had no real training in anything. He had come out of a kind of dissenting religious background, had written an early influential book on linguistics, kind of radical linguistics. In fact, he charted this path of radical politics and radical linguistics that basically Noam Chomsky would end up doing 200 years later. No one else has quite done that combination since or before. And he started dabbling in a whole number of fields. He got interested in electricity. He met Ben Franklin in 1765, crucially at a coffee house in London, where Franklin used to hang out, and Priestley persuaded Franklin to let him write a book about electricity. Priestley had this idea that there were all these amazing discoveries that were happening in the field of electricity, many of which Franklin had pioneered, and it would be important for somebody to come along and write a real kind of popular account of it, write it in English first, which was an innovation. A lot of scholarship at the time was written in Latin, and to really tell the story of how this science had developed and flourished over the last 50 years, and how it had all these interesting practical applications, and how people at home in their home labs could build, take a little electrical machine and do these interesting experiments. And so he wrote this book on the history of electricity, which really, in many ways, invented the whole genre of popular science writing, which is kind of how I make my living now. So I'm indebted to Priestley in that sense. And it was very important because, one, in the sense that it was about spreading the ideas and getting ordinary people involved in scientific research and teaching them the magic of all the stuff that had happened. But it was important also in that it created this really extraordinary friendship between Franklin and Priestley that lasted many years and shaped both their lives in crucial ways. And one of the interesting little footnotes to this is that that book on electricity is the first place that anyone had publicly written about Franklin's famous experiment with the kite. So that classic, you know, school kid image we all have of Ben Franklin, the great pioneering kite-flying, slightly insane guy with the lightning storm, comes from Joseph Priestley, actually. Priestley was one who was like, that's a great story. I'm going to write a book that talks about that. So Priestley and Franklin had developed this friendship. And Priestley then got interested in this question of air and of gases. And in part, one of the reasons why he got interested in it was that he accidentally moved in next door to a brewery. We'll talk a little bit about his religious side, but he was a minister as well as a pioneering chemist and linguist and political radical, as people were back in the day. And someone said reading about this book that they read the whole thing and they thought, what have I done with my life? This guy is so accomplished. So he'd gotten a new gig as a minister in a church in Leeds, and the minister's house wasn't quite ready, and so they moved in temporarily to this house that was adjacent to a brewery. And ever inquisitive, Priestley kind of walked over and started investigating, and he noticed that they had these giant vats of beer that were brewing, and he saw this kind of gas, kind of haze coming off the liquid, and he thought, well, this is going to be a great place to do experiments. So he asked the proprietors if it would be all right if he could do a little work over their beer, and I love that image of just this kind of eccentric minister from next door comes over to the brewery and, can I open up a little lab here over your beer? And so one of the things that he does is one of the early experiments he does is he starts pouring water back and forth over this brewing beer, and he accidentally invents soda water. He passes it back and forth, and he realizes that it creates this nice little carbonated fizzy flavor, and instantly, you know, sends off letters to everyone about it, says, oh, I've invented this wonderful beverage, and it's just delightful, and, you know, if you put a little juice in it, it's really tasty, a little wine. He almost invented the wine cooler. And he thought for a while that actually it was going to fight scurvy, but successfully. But it didn't, in fact, have anything to do with scurvy. So that was a little bit of a false lead. But it was typical of Priestley, and it was typical of Franklin too, to share his ideas and his innovations with anyone who was interested in listening to them. He had almost to a fault no interest in making any money or keeping anything proprietary in anything he did, which put him in a situation where he was constantly trying to find support for his work. A few years later, actually, a certain Johann Schweppes patented as a tonic water and did a little bit better with it, since we're still paying royalties on it to this day, anytime you have a gin and tonic most of the time. So Priestley was very much about the kind of the open flow of ideas, and he and Franklin really, really shared that value. And at a certain point, at Leeds, in 1771, he got interested in this problem of air and plants. And he had known for a long time, and everyone had known for a long time, that if you took an organism, if you took a mouse, as Priestley did many, many times, and put it in a concealed vessel of some kind, at a certain point, the creature would run out of air and would go into convulsions and eventually die if you didn't open it up and let more air in there. Now, they didn't quite understand why that was happening. They didn't know if the mouse was somehow poisoning the environment or if the mouse, there was something about the limited space. They didn't understand it entirely. But they knew that would happen. And Priestley's brother, actually, his memories of Priestley as an 11-year-old trapping little spiders and watching them die in a little glass, which nowadays would get you put into some kind of remedial physician for troubled children who are killing spiders in jars. But back in the day, it was a sign of a budding genius. And so he'd long known about this, and everyone had known about this. And then he had this idea, which no one seems to have had before that, which is to say, well, what would happen if you put a plant in a similar situation? And so he took a little mint plant from his garden, and pretty much everything he did was stuff that you could do in your own kitchen. He did all of his experiments pretty much in a big laundry sink that he'd kind of stolen from his wife, and he would go into the kitchen and steal beer glasses. And there's a lot of beer. There's a lot of beer and coffee in this book. And he would pull these mint plants out of the garden. And so he isolated this mint plant, sealed it up, and then, you know, went away and kind of waited for it to die and would come back, you know, day after day, week after week, and this thing just kept growing. And so he thought, well, that's puzzling. And so then he had this idea. He thought, well, what would happen? He knew from the mice experiments that if you lit a candle in a sealed vessel, which he would do with a little lens, so he would concentrate the sun's rays, light the candle inside this sealed vessel, and then burn all the oxygen out of the vessel, and then, you know, almost instantly the mouse would die because there was nothing to breathe. And then at that point it would be impossible to light the candle again because there's no air in there, right? And so he thought, well, I'm going to try that again with a plant instead of a mouse. And so he isolated the little bit of mint and lit the candle from the outside, burned all the oxygen out, and then he put it down and waited to see what would happen. And days passed, and the plant seemed fine. It continued to grow. Little roots started to appear. And then about 2 weeks later, he went back and tried to light the candle, and the candle lit. This little flame appeared. So there had been no combustible air in there before. All of that had been burned out, and somehow, without any new air coming in, that air had been created. So somehow the plant was creating that combustible air. And in that little vessel, in that little kind of globe with this little plant, was a clue to how our whole planet evolved in the history of life on this planet. Because the natural levels of oxygen on Earth before the plants evolved was something like less than 1%. We do not have a big bubble of oxygen around us because that's the kind of innate state of the Earth. We have that because billions of years ago, plants evolved the strategy of extracting energy from the sun, we call photosynthesis, that had a waste product called oxygen. And over time, that oxygen built up as photosynthesis became so successful and as so many organisms spread around the globe. Over time, that bubble grew until they reached a point of remarkable stabilization, actually, which is a whole other scientific story, of about 20%. And this was initially the world's greatest pollution crisis. Oxygen is a deadly chemical in many ways. So there were all these organisms that instantly died in contact with oxygen. It was a terrible early bacterial holocaust. But over time, organisms evolved that made a living off of oxygen and figured out ways to extract energy from oxygen. And we are their descendants. We live because of this invention of air many billions of years ago as an accidental byproduct of photosynthesis. And that was what Joseph Priestley was seeing in this little orb here. But what's wonderful about this story is he didn't fully realize it. He knew that there was something interesting happening. And so what he did was he started writing letters to his friends about it. And one of the first people he wrote to about it was Benjamin Franklin. And one of the things that's great about doing research for this book, and I hope it comes across in reading it, is that so much of these conversations are preserved in the correspondence between these people. And because he was in Leeds and Franklin was most of the time in London, a lot of their important conversations actually took place in forms that we can see the actual original words of. And And Franklin wrote back to Priestley after he got word of this experiment, and he took it to kind of the next level, basically. He said, that sounds like a rational system. It sounds like probably a system that happens on a kind of a global level. I mean, all around the world, we've seen things like fire will purify water, and it probably makes sense that the Earth needs some kind of, that nature needs some kind of mechanism for purifying the air. And so it would make sense that probably the plants are doing it. And so right there, you see this collaboration between these two men, where Priestley has half of an idea, and Franklin has the other half that kind of completes it. And when you have those two ideas together, what you have is really, I think, one of the core beginning moments of the ecosystem's view of the world. The idea that we live in a connected web of life and of energy, of all these forces, that we exist because other organisms are creating an atmosphere that we're able to thrive in. And that it's incumbent on us to recognize that connection and to preserve it and to safeguard it in many ways. And in fact, Franklin, in that very letter, took it to that next step beyond just from ecosystems, almost to the beginning of kind of green politics, which is, he has a wonderful line where he says, I hope this will temper the rage of late of people cutting down trees near houses because the trees are supposed to make the air unwholesome. In America, we have lots of trees, and we're the healthiest people that ever lived, you know, something like that. And so right there, you can see him saying, you know, not only is there this connected web of life on the Earth, but, you know, we have to be careful about it. We need to not just chop it all down. So right there is this extraordinary little exchange, and so I heard about this, and the more I kind of read into it, I thought, this is a great story. And then the more I read about Priestley, the more I realized that he was bound up in all these wonderful ways with the American founding fathers. And in some ways, as I describe in the book, he was kind of this Zelig of early American history. He keeps showing up at all these unusual points. And yet, in most accounts of this period, he's not talked about very much, or he's almost just kind of a footnote. And what ends up happening is he developed a number of other controversial ideas that were very influential, but also got a lot of people angry with him over the years. He moved up to Birmingham, became part of the wonderful Lunar Society up there, and played a role in the kind of formation of the Industrial Revolution, was friends with people like James Watt, became a little bit more politicized, was one of the major supporters of the American cause, probably one of the two or three most vocal supporters in Britain of the American cause in the Revolutionary War, and was a supporter of the French Revolution, which also made him the enemy of a number of folks in England at the time. And he co-founded the Unitarian Church in England, just as a kind of side thing. And he had a number of kind of radical religious views that were very controversial at the time. He had a kind of an empiricist approach to the history of the Christian Church. He believed that he was a fascinating combination of a very devout man who was a Christian to the very end of his life, but believed that his vision of Christianity was about the original words of Jesus and the original message of Jesus that had been kind of compromised by later scholars over time who had introduced all these kind of supernatural distortions, as he said, to the Christian tradition. And he wrote a number of books about this, including a very influential one about the corruptions of Christianity, which had a huge impact on Thomas Jefferson. And in fact, the final kind of tipping point in my own head about deciding to write this book was reading that Jefferson had ultimately credited Priestley with keeping him a Christian. And all the challenges and the, you know, kind of complicated faith that Jefferson had, when he read Priestley's books about the corruptions of Christianity, he said, "This is my faith. This man understands this better than anyone else." So that was the point where I thought, "This is going to be a really interesting project to go on." So he, in doing all these things, he had basically offended a lot of people, and by the early 1790s, he became in some ways the most hated man in all of England, and it eventually got so intense that an old-fashioned angry mob came and burned his house down and really was actually set out to try and kill him and ended up in the Birmingham riots burning down about a dozen houses around Birmingham. He managed to escape but never really felt safe again in England. And so in 1794, he set sail for America. And in doing that, he really inaugurated one of the great amazing traditions in the American experience, which was that he was kind of our first great scientist exile. He was the first great kind of dissident scientist who decided to come to America to find a country where his ideas would be allowed to develop unfettered by angry mobs and the state and the king. And so he got here and was greeted as a hero. He had developed a friendship with Adams when Adams was in London, and he spent quite a bit of time in Adams. There's a funny little side note where all the major founders kind of vie to get Priestley to move to their part of the country. Adams is like, all the intellectuals live in Boston. And, you know, Jefferson is like, Monticello, the climate is so wonderful. And they go back and forth. And eventually he decides to live in rural Pennsylvania, which was an odd choice. He had this vision of kind of a utopian society that he was going to build in Pennsylvania that did not pan out. But he moved there, but he spent a lot of time in Philadelphia. And he initially was very close to Adams, but he and Adams had a little bit of a falling out. And then he got very close to Jefferson, had a wonderful correspondence with Jefferson. And when Adams got elected president with Jefferson as vice president, when the rift develops between Adams and Jefferson, you know, over a number of things, but largely over France, Priestley decides to pretty much throw his lot in with Jefferson. And he starts writing, having come to America to try and stay out of trouble. He kind of wasn't quite able to do that. And so he starts writing some pamphlets kind of in support of Jefferson and more explicitly in very critical of Adams. And he had a colleague out in Pennsylvania named Thomas Cooper who wrote even more vitriolic attacks on Adams. And so when the Alien and Sedition Acts are passed, Thomas Cooper is actually arrested, is one of the few people who are actually arrested in Alien and Sedition. And Priestley is put on the hit list of people who should be deported for their criticism of the Adams administration. And it's an extraordinary turning point in this country's history because right there you have this very important question about what kind of country are we going to be building here? What do we do with our dissenting intellectuals in this country? When someone, I mean, Priestley at that point was probably the most prominent scientist and theologian alive in the United States, and he'd had the audacity to criticize the Adams administration, and we all know from various forms how thin-skinned Adams could be. And so there was this big question of what kind of country are we going to be? I mean, are we going to arrest and deport and incarcerate people like Joseph Priestley, or are we going to let them write their pamphlets and, you know, argue it out in the public sphere? And so he was right there, and he was probably the biggest kind of test of Adams' true feelings about Alien and Sedition and his true feelings about Priestley and all of this. And while he was famously combustible and thin-skinned, Adams in this one point decided to blink, and he advised his people to not do anything with Priestley. He said, he's an old man, he's living out in the woods, and his influence is not an atom in this world, which if you look at all the evidence, it's clear that that was not true. He was an enormously influential writer and figure, and he had the ear of the vice president, who was at that point pretty much Adams' nemesis. So the whole question of why Adams kind of spared Priestley is a very interesting one. My assessment of it, based on what I've read and what I've looked at, is that it was a case of just a kind of a personal connection. He could not bring himself to bring the force of law on his old friend, but it's a hard one to call. So Priestley is spared. He dodges this bullet. And then several years later, Jefferson is elected president. And one of the first things he does is he writes Joseph Priestley a letter. He gets word that Priestley has been quite seriously ill in Pennsylvania. And so one of his kind of first written acts as president is to write Priestley a letter. And he writes an amazing letter. You should read it in its entirety. I won't do that. But it effectively is initially saying, you know, I've heard you were ill, and I'm glad you're recovered. Yours is one of the great lives that all thinking people want to see continue. You know, you are one of my great heroes. And then he goes on to talk about how horrible the Adams administration has been, and basically to apologize for Priestley's treatment. And he talks about how the Adams administration was all about looking backwards, not forwards. It was against the innovations of science, that he and Priestley understood that this was a forward-looking country and that it was not about the education of our ancestors, whereas Adams was all about that old stuff, and they were about new stuff. And it's this great kind of trashing of Adams and embracing of Priestley that goes on for quite a while. And then he has this amazing kind of stirring passage, one of the most beautiful kind of optimistic things he ever wrote, which I just want to read briefly, which he's talking about how he feels now that the country has weathered this storm and survived it and not chosen the path of deporting somebody like Priestley. So he wrote this extraordinary passage. As the storm is now subsiding, and I'm not going to assume too much about the politics in this room, but I think there's maybe some relevant to today. As the storm is now subsiding and the horizon becoming serene, it is pleasant to consider the phenomenon with attention. We can no longer say there is nothing new under the sun, for this whole chapter in the history of man is new. The great extent of our republic is new. Its sparse habitation is new. The mighty wave of public opinion which has rolled over it is new. But the most pleasing novelty is, it so quietly subsiding over such an extent of surface to its true level again. The order and good sense displayed in this recovery from delusion and in the momentous crisis which lately arose really bespeak a strength of character in our nation which augurs well for the duration of our republic, and I am much better satisfied now of its stability than I was before it was tried. That is, the world of politics is viewed from the eyes of an Enlightenment rationalist, right? That in a sense, this is the American experiment is literally an experiment, and on some level, you have to run the data and see what happens and test it and test its resilience and its internal stability to see if it really works. And so he writes this letter, amazing letter. Priestley dies about 3 years later. And one of his last messages he sends off to Jefferson saying, you know, tell Mr. Jefferson that, I'm not going to last much longer, but I'm honored to die under his administration in a country where I finally feel at home and at peace, though I'm going to somewhere better. He was religious to the very end. And then eight years pass. And through this period, Adams and Jefferson famously don't talk to each other. And, you know, this old camaraderie and friendship that is broken apart over things like alien sedition and things like Priestley. They don't speak. And then all of a sudden, letters start to appear going back and forth between Quincy and Monticello, and it's the beginning of the famous Adams-Jefferson correspondence. But those first letters, if you go back and read them, they're very kind of delicate and tiptoey. They don't really get into anything of substance. It's two old lions who got into a huge fight and now are trying to figure out a way to talk to each other again. And so they do it by talking about how many grandchildren they have, you know. And it's like, how's the weather down there? And one of the things I love is they're always talking about how the mail, like, the, wow, that letter got here in 11 days. That was very fast. How long did my letter take, right? And they're all kind of nerds in this way. There's a kind of founding nerds quality to this book. So they start this kind of delicate conversation, and then a book is published in England. And it's a book of Reverend Lindsay's letters, the guy who co-founded Unitarianism, the Unitarian Church in England, with Priestley. And it's his correspondence, and it includes a letter written from Jefferson to Priestley from 1801. And somehow this book travels across the Atlantic and finds its way to Quincy, Massachusetts, into the hands of John Adams, who reads this letter that Jefferson had written to Priestley, talking all this trash about his administration and making him sound incredibly backwards and opposed to science in all these ways. And you can imagine the response that Adams has. So he fires off this missive to Monticello, which is basically saying, what is this letter? You know, and he says, do you know of this letter? You know, do you know of its existence? You know, I have many more things to say about it, but for now, please acknowledge that you know of this letter, right? So he sends it off. But of course, it takes like 14 days for the letter to get down there and everything, and Adams can't sit around. And so he fires off like six more letters every day. And each one of them takes a little bit of the letter that Jefferson had written to Priestley, takes a little paragraph or a little quote and says, how dare you say that? You know, that's ridiculous. And the first thing he starts with, and I think this is one of the important lessons of the book, of all the critiques that Jefferson has leveled against Adams in this letter, the first thing he fires off is, how dare you say that I am resistant to the innovations of science? I've never said anything like that in my life. It goes against everything I've ever believed, and I demand proof that I've ever said anything like that when I was president. You think right there that, you know, of all the accusations that he's made, the thing that hurt the most was this idea that he was an anti-science president. So eventually Jefferson writes back this wonderful, calming, soothing note saying, you know, oh, my dear friend, that was so long ago. But he kind of holds his own. He says, but, however, I did have a point, and there were many abuses, and they were mostly directed at my people, not at your people. And it's through that exchange, that's the point when the real conversation begins between those two men. And they start talking about what the revolution meant, what the Constitution meant, what the American experiment really stood for, why science seemingly had progressed so much faster than civil society and forms of government, what the role of technology was in all of this, the religious values that Priestley had brought in. Priestley is mentioned 52 times in the Jefferson Adams letters, whereas Franklin and Washington and Hamilton are mentioned between them less than 10 times. And so you can see the impact that he had. And in some ways, he was the catalyst, although he had been dead for 8 years, getting these two men to talk to each other again in this amazing way. And that turns into the great American political conversation that we're still going back and rereading to this day. So he's everywhere. He's wound through this story in all these unusual ways. And I think what I wanted to do in this book is to go back and revive them a little bit, but also to look at the founders through this kind of outsider angle of Priestley's life and his values. And when you look at, particularly at Franklin and Jefferson and to some extent Adams, in the context of their collaborations with Priestley and their friendship with Priestley, I think what it really emphasizes is a couple of things. The first is that all these men really had a unified worldview, that they did not believe it was possible or responsible to kind of compartmentalize the insights of science and the advances of technology and the new experiments in political life and religious life, that these things all existed like ecosystems in a kind of connected web, and that one had to be versed in all of them and one had to reach out and find connections, and that the informed life, the educated life, was about making those connections. And I start the book with a quote from an unnamed political candidate, but I'll name him for you, which is Mike Huckabee. And in one of the debates from a year and a half ago, he was asked about his belief in evolution. And he said a very telling thing. It was a classic Huckabee line in that it was very funny. But it had a kind of a telling subtext to it, which is he said, I'm actually kind of find it amusing that I'm being asked this question. You know, I'm asking to be your president. I'm not asking to write an eighth grade science textbook. And it was the kind of remark that for it to be funny, you had to go into it with a basic assumption, which is that the world of science is irrelevant to the world of being president. And on some level, if he had said, I can't believe you're asking me about foreign policy, I'm not here to write a textbook about international affairs, I just want to be president, no one would have taken, you know, wouldn't have been funny, wouldn't have made any sense. But somehow it worked as a joke because we have this kind of belief, or some of us have this belief, that science is just for the guys in the lab coats and that politics is somewhere else. But if you think about all the issues that confront us today, all the energy issues, environmental issues, all the issues that have come out of the tremendous changes that have come from computer science in the form of the internet, stem cell research, genomics, everything we're starting to understand about the human brain, it's not that we need to have scientist presidents, but on some basic level, when you look at the story from this angle, you have to say that taking that kind of attitude is not just irresponsible and it's not just anti-intellectual, it's on some fundamental level un-American. And so what I wanted to do with this book is to take us back to this period and say, these are our roots, right? You know, this is the sensibility that this country came out of, and we need to return to them because these are the values that made these people so inspiring, and I hope that they continue to inspire us in this way today. That's my spiel. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. So there are a lot of themes here, and there are a lot of things that I didn't talk about. So I'd love to get into any of this.
Hi. I was struck by something in your author's note about the, you were talking about connecting social history, chemistry, media theory, ecosystem science, geology, and this connective sensibility runs against the grain of our specialized intellectual culture, but it would have been second nature to Priestley and those others. It struck me because that's how I found out about Priestley. It was in eighth grade in a class that was canceled after our eighth grade class had gone through. It was called Core Science, where we had social studies, English, and science together. And our teacher actually was a chemist, and he told us, you know, all these great stories about Priestley. And, you know, we did things like we read Gulliver's Travels and looked at it from the scientific viewpoint. Is it possible that the Brobdingnagians could exist or the Lilliputians could see? And not just the satire and the English and the historical part. But I'm just wondering, is that because of, you know, your interest in science and education, I think, is getting so specialized in all these tests with the No Child Left Behind. Is there a way in the way you envision it that children can get exposure to, you know, larger and more integrative kinds of things instead of just specialists?
Oh, it's five good questions in there, and I will answer all of them. So one of the things I tried to do in the book that we didn't really talk about is there's a method to the book that's a little bit different in the sense, and this is what I've called in various contexts a kind of a long zoom approach, which is when you try and ask, one of the questions that the book really tries to ask is, why do intellectual breakthroughs happen? Why do we have paradigm shifts in society? Why is somebody like Priestley involved in so many of them at one given time? And so there's part of the storytelling here, which is, you know, this happened, then this happened, this happened, and then it ended, and there's kind of that narrative flow. But there's also this, I think, equally important, maybe more important question of why did it happen? And my argument here, and this was the argument in Ghost Map, and actually in a funny way in Everything Bad is Good for You as well, is to answer the question of why, you have to work across different scales of experience. So the individual genius, great man theory of history is not sufficient, although Priestley was undoubtedly a great man and a genius in all these different ways, and we should celebrate that and not throw that away. But we also have to look at lots of other different parts of the society, and in fact, parts of the society that often work in different timescales. So one big theme of the book is how intellectual activity at any given time is greatly shaped by the larger macro flows of energy through society. So Priestley literally lived off of the stored energy that was being kind of unleashed with the Industrial Revolution. He moved to Birmingham, lived off of the kind of excess profits of these early industrialists. And that was energy that actually had been trapped 300 million years ago during the Carboniferous Age, which was actually caused in part by the buildup of oxygen in the atmosphere created by the plants that Priestley was the first person to understand. And so to really explain why Priestley at that moment, you have to talk about his life and about his biography and about his friends and about the information network and the postal system, and you have to talk about the Carboniferous era. Because if you don't talk about all those different levels, you haven't told the whole story. So part of what I try and do with my work is to make those connections and make them fun and interesting, and so that people do like that kind of widening perspective. I think for kids, this is the connection to the video games book, is that that way of thinking about the world is actually wonderfully taught in some very popular games that are out there. So this game Spore that came out last year is one of the big hits of this year, where as a kid, you know, 7-year-old plays this game, and they start as a single-celled organism, and then they evolve into a creature, and then they build a tribe, and then they build a city, and then they colonize a planet, and then they develop technology that lets them go to other planets. And so they're thinking in playing this game across all these different scales of experience. So that's the exercise, the kind of mental exercise that a 7-year-old is getting now for fun, as opposed to what I was doing when I was 7, which was watching The Love Boat on TV. And so I think there's opportunity to use tools like that to teach people to think across disciplines and across scales. So I'm hopeful for that. And the other day, I have a 7-year-old and a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old, and the 7-year-old was off playing soccer, and I sat down with the 5-year-old and was like, okay, your brother's playing soccer, so I know you're a little jealous. We can do anything. What do you want to do? What do you want to do? And he thought about it, and he said, I think I'd like to do a science experiment. And I thought, okay, we're on the right track here. This is really good. But I made him play games anyway, so that was it. Thank you.
I wish I could say I purchased your book and read it thoroughly, but I did hear you on NPR. And
what else
you touched on something that may have fueled Priestley and how productive he was, and just the difference of where things were germinated. And instead of a pub, it was a coffee house?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that out. It's one of my favorite little side stories about it. So talk about the flow of energy through society. It's crucial to this story that Priestley and Franklin met at a coffee house, at the London Coffee House near St. Paul's. I went there just a while ago. There's no marker for it, even though it was this amazing kind of hotbed of intellectual activity during the period, although there is a Starbucks quite near there, so that's some part of it. But it's crucial to the story in two ways. One, the coffee house was a kind of an intellectual melting pot where people from various different intellectual backgrounds would come together and kind of trade ideas and hang out and talk. And so Franklin had a group called the Club of Honest Whigs who would get together and they would talk politics and religion and electricity and chemistry and anything else they were kind of interested in. And they would go on for hours and hours and hours. And a remarkable number of key kind of innovations in British society during that period come out of coffee houses. I mean, you know, the whole insurance business was invented in Lloyd's Coffee House, which became Lloyd's of London, because it was a place where the ship captains could come together with the, you know, kind of emerging businessmen who were thinking about insuring ships and things like that. So the coffee house culture as a place of interdisciplinary thinking and as an actual physical space for it was very important. But there's another important fact, which is the actual drug caffeine that was being conveyed by all this coffee, because up until that, until really a century before, by far and away the dominant daytime drug of choice for both mass and elite in England was alcohol. Connecting to my last book, the water just wasn't really safe to drink. And so it was a health decision, a lifestyle health decision. It was a smart one, given the options. You just drank booze all day, and people would wake up at 9 and start drinking beer. And so, you know, think about how your life would be different, and I hope that this would be different for most of you, if you woke up, you know, every morning and were like, all right, whew, boy, that was a good night's sleep, but I'm going to have my first beer. And so you had really an entire culture that for many centuries was just drunk all day. When tea and coffee first came over and were incredibly expensive and exotic things, but there was so much demand for them that the price drops in this extraordinary way over about 100 years, and it becomes a kind of a mass beverage. it is not an accident that the Enlightenment happened as coffee got introduced to this culture. I mean, you change the culture from, you know, a depressant to a stimulant, and everybody changes over. You're going to get smarter, more alert people, and you're going to get better empirical science. I mean, it's just going to happen. So it's a funny little theme. And now, those of you who know me personally know how much coffee I drink might think that perhaps I'm just justifying my habit, but I really think that there's some evidence here.
Thanks very much for a great book and a great discussion tonight. Thank you. The question I have goes to something that you brought up earlier, and that is innovation. Several weeks ago, we had an author here who said that some innovators don't really deserve a lot of credit because they're standing on the shoulders of everybody that went before. And he used Bill Gates as an example.
Right. Was this Gladwell?
Well, so the question for you is, in your book, you talked about Thomas Kuhn and his book on paradigm shifts, and it seemed to me that you were leaning towards the idea that there are spark plug people and paradigm shifts really happen, and that somehow maybe people like Priestley really do deserve to be seen in a light that's different than just simply following on step by step and what went before them.
Yeah, I think I would say that. I think there's a lot of – so it's interesting. I don't know if this was Malcolm Gladwell who was saying this, but there's been this interesting kind of overlap in our approaches in this book, and I think that Malcolm is – there's some commonality in the way that we approach things on a number of levels. In my mind, what happens is when you have periods of radical change, what often happens is if you think of that metaphor of the long zoom and you think of these different scales, everything from accidents of biography, innate genius, all the way down to the carboniferous layer of coal deposits sitting under your society. My hunch is, and I've only really kind of applied this approach in a couple of case studies, but my hunch is that when we have periods of great breakthroughs, this was certainly true in the case of cholera in 1854 in the last book, what's often happening is that, in a sense, all those kind of layers are stacking up and aligning in some way. And so you do have a great genius. You have Priestley, you have John Snow, and you do have the right moment in kind of technological history. And Priestley needed the tools he was using. If he hadn't had an air pump, if an air pump hadn't been invented 100 years before, he wouldn't have been able to do what he was doing. If he hadn't had the carboniferous layer fueling and funding his innovations, he would have had a hard time doing what he was doing. And so it's not that the great man or the great genius or the great woman is irrelevant, and they have to be part of the story. And I hope one of the things that comes across in the book is that Priestley's just an amazing guy, and just hearing about him as an individual is interesting. But it's also more than that. And so it's not to discount the genius, but it's to say that there are these kind of historical layers that support us at these different points. And to understand why things happen, why big things happen, we have to be able to understand all of them. And I think that's an idea that Priestley would have appreciated. All right. Thank you very much. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, visit npr.org/booktour.